We're reading Adi Lila 14, 51, 58. No? 57-58. Okay. When some of the girls fled, the Lord called them in anger and advised them as follows. Translation. If you are miserly and do not give me the offerings, every one of you will have an old husband with at least four co-wives. So when I sat down, two devotees asked me, they said, are you going to give a class about polygamy? And I thought, well, no, I haven't actually come here with that intention. I wonder why you would ask that question. Now I know. Purport. In India in those days, and even until 50 years ago, this is the 1920s probably talking about, polygamy was freely allowed. Any man, especially of the higher castes, the Brahmins, the Vaishyas, and particularly the Kshatriyas, could marry more than one wife. In the Mahabharata, or the old history of India, we see that Kshatriya kings especially used to marry many wives. According to Vedic civilization, there was no restriction against this, and even a man more than 50 years old could marry. That's page 163, text. I'm just making a note of that. According to Vedic civilization, yes. But to be married to a man who had many wives was not a very pleasing situation, because the husband's love would be divided among his many wives. Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu apparently wanted to curse the girls unwilling to offer him the naivedya, which is the boga offering, the food offering, that they were offering to Durga, to be married to men who had at least four wives. The social structure allowing a man to marry more than one wife can be supported in this way. Generally, in every society, the female population is greater in number than the male population. Therefore, if it is a principle in the society that all girls should be married, unless polygamy is allowed, it will not be possible. If all the girls are not married, there is a good chance of adultery, and a society in which adultery is allowed cannot be very peaceful or pure. In our Krishna consciousness society, we have restricted illicit sex life. The practical difficulty is to find a husband for each and every girl. We are therefore in favor of polygamy, provided, of course, that the husband is able to maintain more than one wife. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Any questions? Prabhupada gave a talk in New York. I should say, Srila Prabhupada gave a talk in New York. And he said, so fasting actually means feasting. Fasting actually means feasting. To control the tongue, to control the senses, means to use the tongue only for vibrating the names of Krishna and only for eating food that has been offered to Krishna. He said, for fasting means feasting. And all the devotees went, hooray! Then Prabhupada went to Los Angeles, and the following morning he gave Bhagavatam class. And he said, so fasting means controlling the tongue. You must fast, must not eat, must restrict the senses. This is the path of Krishna consciousness. This is yoga. He said, senses are like snakes that must be controlled. Well, silence. There were some devotees in the audience who'd been the previous day in New York. And they said to Prabhupada, yesterday you said controlling the tongue means feasting, and today you say controlling the tongue means fasting. And instead of Prabhupada getting into a lengthy discussion about it, he just looked and he said, you listened to me yesterday, you listened to me today. In other words, yesterday was concessional, today is, restriction. And there's always these two aspects to Prabhupada's instructions. One seems to be concessional. Oh, hello, Sutapa, you're there. Okay. There always seems to be a concessional, that yes, simply, all you have to do, chant 16 rounds, follow these principles, it's like recreation. And at the end of your life, go back home, back to Godhead. Wonderful. So easy. Where is the difficulty? Huh? Where is the difficulty? And then in the other set of statements, we find other things, that it is so difficult to become Krishna conscious. You have to be 100% pure. You have to follow this your entire life. You have made vows while you breaking your vows. You know, I've given you initiation. Why are you breaking these vows? You must be 100% surrendered to Krishna like this. And so, which set of Prabhupada's instructions do we follow? There is always a broad range of instructions. And we will always find the Prabhupada that we like at some point in the spectrum. Well, Prabhupada said this. As Kripa Moya said it the other day, there was a class, and it said, I can have more than one wife. In fact, I can have four wives. I'll chip in what I can, and Social Security will do the rest. Okay? That seems to be a very good idea. It's bona fide. So thinking in this way, a devotee who should have known better came to Prabhupada. He said, Prabhupada, I'm seeking your blessings if I can have more than one wife. Prabhupada said, oh, yes. He said, why? Is this something that I've told you? He said, well, actually, Prabhupada, yes, it is. And I've gone through your books, and I've made a deep study of your books to really understand your subject, this subject, from your point of view. And so from his bag, he produced this typewritten document, which was sheets and sheets of everywhere where Prabhupada says that polygamy, Vedic culture, etc., etc. And he placed them on the desk in front of Prabhupada. Prabhupada just looked at him with a very stern face, and he said, this is how you want to use my books? Is this how you want to use my books? In other words, you'll find things there, and if you take them all out and you stitch them together, you'll have a document for your life. But you better be prepared for the guru to have a purport on your selected purports. And that's why you need the guru to give you the purport, because you may stitch together all the purports in the book and come out with something that is really feeding the ego. Whereas Prabhupada said to have a guru is suicide of the false ego. Suicide of the false ego. You heard that one? It's a great quote. Is it initiation is suicide of the false ego? It means when you give up what I want. So looking at Prabhupada's purports with what I want, you'll find the purport that you want. Looking at Srila Prabhupada's purports with what he wants for you, you'll find that too. So it's an open book. It's an open book. But you'll get out of Prabhupada's books what you put in. So you put in egotism, and this is a very nice purport, isn't it? And why is he talking like this? He's talking like this because the verse, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was having fun with these young girls who all want a husband. So any girl in Indian culture, if they want a husband, they worship Bhavani, because she has the best husband. If you're married to Lord Shiva, you know, may not be able to give you a big house. But if you're the goddess in charge of material energy, then you don't worry about such things. To have a husband like Shiva. Everybody would want to have a husband like Lord Shiva. And so they worship her and say, please take me into your inner circle. You are the goddess with the best husband. If I worship you, if I ask you, perhaps you will be merciful to me. But then Lord Chaitanya said, no, you've offered some nice food to Bhavani. I want that. He said, no, you can't have that. That's an offering. Okay? It's like if some man in the corridor approaches, you know, Lalita Sakhi as she's pushing Krishna's, you know, sacred, what do they call it? Trolley? Sacred trolley? We put all kinds of signs on it, don't we? Do not leave anything on this sacred trolley. People come and then we have people lining up to touch the trolley. And yeah, must be sacred, you know. Okay, Gadadhar gave you the holy hat, as people are calling it now. But have you touched the holy trolley? Someone comes up to the trolley and sees or smells the nice dishes covered in cloths on their way down to the altar. And someone says, I'll have that. I heard that you cook really nicely in this place, you know. I'll have that. You see, what would you think of such a person? You'd think he was uncouth, wouldn't you? It's like the chef, Gordon Ramsay, who comes into restaurants and sort of sets the poor restaurants back on their feet by redesigning the decor and the meals. He came to Govinda's for a little while, and he was helping them to come up with different salads. But the first thing the devotees had to tell him was no swearing, okay, and no tasting. Okay, these are the two rules we have in this restaurant. No meat, fish, eggs, and no tasting, and no swearing. As you cook, your consciousness has to be high. Okay, I don't really think he understood what high was. I definitely didn't understand what consciousness was. Your consciousness has to be high. We're cooking for Krishna. Okay? And he says, well, if I was cooking for Krishna, I'd cook the salads. I'd do the salads like this. I said, I think there's a better salad that you could have. So he went about. So if a person comes and says, I want that, that's for me, you think this person really doesn't understand what a temple about is all about. A temple, the operating system in a temple is idam na mama. Idam, this, na mama, is not for me. This is not for me. The curtains are not for me, and the worship here is not for me, the flower garland's not for me, the charanamrita was for someone else, is not for me, okay? The floor is for me, the dust of the feet of the devotees, that's for me. But everything else, I'm the humble servant of that principle. So here is Lord Chaitanya, and he's saying, he's not saying idam na mama, he's saying mama. He said, that's mine. Give it to me. And they're refusing. The girls are refusing, and quite rightly. But in this incarnation, he's trying to prove a point that actually Krishna is Avatari, and he's Devishwar. He's Yogeshwar and Devishwar. And he's in charge of all the gods, all the goddesses, and anything that we really need comes from him. So you should actually be offering that food to me. You should actually be offering the food to me. Why aren't you doing that? And then he curses them. But he's just a boy. So he's having fun. It's a joke. He's teasing the girls. So take it seriously, but not too seriously. He's having fun, okay? So maybe we should have an emoji by this verse, you know, so people can understand, you know. Okay? I'm down with the kids, you know. Down with the kids. So then he says, if you're miserly and you don't give me the offerings, every one of you will have an old husband with at least four co-wives. Now, that's a real curse for a young girl. Real curse for the young girl because, see, these girls didn't know. They knew that Nimai was somebody special. They weren't quite sure what or who or how. But maybe he was in touch with someone. And in those days, people used to think, and quite rightly, that people had different powers, and powers to see the future, powers to see into the past, powers to read the palms and the forehead and do astrology. And, you know, there seems to be invisible power. People seem to be able to call upon the power of the other world, the unseen world. So these girls, they didn't know. Maybe Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was like that. And maybe, you know, he's a Brahmin. He's a Brahmin. And I've heard about Sringi. He was just a boy and he cursed Parikshit, and Parikshit did die within 7 days. So Nimai's a Brahmin. He's a boy. Maybe he will curse us and, you know, maybe bad things will happen. People don't want curses, you see. People don't want to be cursed. They want to be blessed. That's why all Vedic ceremonies is all ashirwad. We're collecting. We have a cup of our heart. We make our heart into a cup and we collect ashirwad, blessings. That's how we try to go through life. So a samskara, a Vedic ceremony, is just an opportunity not to burn some sticks. Okay. That's not what it's about. But it's an opportunity to make our heart into a cup for blessings of the Vaishnavas. And blessings are invisible. We only make them a little bit visible by, you know, something that comes from the hand. So some flower petals, or in Tibet, you know, they use barley powder, and you throw barley powder. Or another, and we throw akshata rice, you know, yellow rice, not cooked rice. That's called khichdi. If you throw khichdi around, that's not very good. But dry rice, akshata. So in this way, we throw something as an indication that my heart is filled with blessings for you, and now I'm really bestowing them upon you. And the visible part of that is that some rice or cloth or water, something like that. Of course, here, every time you wash your plate in the pantry, okay, you wash your plate in the pantry, you get what is known as prokshana. Prokshana means a purification, means where you wash your hands. And because there's no dryer in there, and because there's no towel in there, devotees just go like that. And therefore, we have junior devotees sprinkling prokshana water on senior devotees all the time. This is Vedic culture. Actually, it's the opposite of Vedic culture. So the idea is that blessings flow from senior to junior like a waterfall pours water. And the respect rises from junior devotees to senior devotees like smoke rises from a fire. This is Vedic culture. Senior means someone who's older than you, wiser than you, and if you're a Vaishnav, that just means everybody. Okay? So here, he's a Brahmin, and he's saying something. They're not quite sure. Not quite sure. Maybe he can curse. Maybe he will curse us. And we're so unsure about, A, getting a husband. It's really not sure whether we will. Any girl, before she gets a husband, she's always thinking, I will never get a husband. It's the way it works. Anybody before getting initiated, they're thinking, I think I'll never get initiated. Anybody before they, whatever it is, they think, oh no, woe is me. I'm specially cursed. Because we are discovering our individuality as spirit souls on our way back to Krishna. And we're confident that somehow that there is a Krishna that's reciprocating with us. But Krishna doesn't seem to be reciprocating in the way that I really wanted, materially. Spiritually, that's okay, but materially I could do with... And Krishna, you're the only one I can pray to now. You've told me not to pray to anybody else, so how about showing me some mercy? And therefore, Shruti's mum just passed away, and Shiva Ramaswamy sent a message. He said, everything happens in time, Krishna's time, not our time, not your time, not my time. Everything happens in Krishna's time, okay? But Krishna is here. We are Sharanagatas. We have taken shelter of Krishna. So this is the only thing that we have, the only person we have recourse to. And yet sometimes he doesn't seem to be reciprocating with the other little prayers that we have. I want a wife, I want a husband. And sometimes doesn't seem to be coming, I could really do with some money, Krishna. You gave it to Sudama Brahmin, you know, for a little bag of dried rice. You know, I've given you my life, so, you know, I'm initiated now. I'm one of the in crowd. You know, I don't mind if you treat me like Sudama Brahmin. Give me something. But the acharyas have some commentary on Sudama. They say, yes, Sudama. Sudama was a very special case. He was thinking that if I'm poor, then I'm dearer to God than if I'm rich. Because as we know, wealthy people, they're all enjoyers. And so that means that if I'm poor, I'll be very lacking in enjoyment and therefore dear to Krishna. No, he was thinking the wrong way. So in order to smash that conception, Krishna gave him wealth. Krishna gave him wealth to destroy this idea that if I'm poor, that's better for my Krishna consciousness. And it's an idea that many people have that attachment to, that being Krishna consciousness, in Krishna consciousness, means I must be poor. Interesting, isn't it? And we have devotees that come to me, and I won't mention any names, but they're saying, how is it possible? I saw someone get out of a BMW in the manor, back to Vedanta Manor. He got out of a BMW. He was wearing a suit and a tie, and he had nice children, and they all had bead bags. That's not Krishna conscious, is it, Kripa Moya? How can that be Krishna consciousness? I said, being Krishna conscious is being conscious of Krishna. Full stop, point. It's being conscious of Krishna in whatever situation you are. And so sometimes the Lord works in such a way to remove mercifully the misconception that we have. Because we've taken Sharanagati, we've made that property, we've gone forward and we've said, as sometimes people say, oh, you know, these ISKCON gurus, they just do the ceremony. It's just burning some wood. It's just a ritual. No, this is going forward to take shelter. This is something that begins in the heart, at the deepest level of the heart. And it's, I now want to... Yes, the guru is a representative of Krishna, but you're saying to Krishna, through the agency of this human being who's your teacher, I, Krishna, now, my Lord, I take shelter of you. I take shelter of you because I've come to the point in my life where I realize that I cannot be happy doing anything else. This is what the Navyagendras say to King Nimi when they come visiting him in his palace. They say, the time, you know, we're here right now, because we sensed a person that was about to surrender. When you're about to surrender, all kinds of things happen. You get the Navyagendras appearing in your house, the six Goswamis showering you with flowers, everything happens. So then a person says, I want to take shelter because I've realized that I can't be happy doing anything else. Only then you should move forward. Only then can you move forward. Otherwise, so many people become... In India, there are... One lady was a member of our group in East London, and she went back to India, and initiation and taking shelter and all these, having a guru, depends on a variety of things. Does the guru speak the same language? Is he in the same country? Is there a cultural resonance I can have with this person? What do other people say about this person, etc. like that. So she took initiation, not in our line, even though she'd been reintroduced to bhakti from our line. We do a lot of introductions. We're like an introduction agency. And then people go on to other things. One thing the Hare Krishna movement has to do and become expert in is not just introducing people, but holding on to them. Please, hold on to some people, okay? We contact a lot of people. We've given Krishna consciousness in the form of book distribution and Harinam to thousands upon thousands of people. We have to, at some stage, hold on to a few of those people by capturing their interest. My wife is a great gardener. She loves gardening. And this time of year is seed planting time. So she plants seeds. So in our house right now, by the radiators and in the sunny window, there's about 50 little trays of seeds, and all these little darlings are just sprouting their green little heads above the soil. So this one's a bean, and this one's a shrub, and this one's a marigold, and this one's a carrot. And then you take them out because they're like children, So she looks after the school, and she's anything that needs a lot of care and attention, she likes doing that. And then she was looking at two trays, and she said, I'm very worried, And when my wife says she's worried, it can either mean that the car is on fire, we've been burgled, or that the seeds are not sprouting. You have to interpret that, And so I said, well, what's the matter? She said, the seeds are not sprouting. Okay, the world has come to an end. It's Armageddon, the apocalypse. World War III, the seeds are not sprouting. So I said, what's the problem? She said, oh, I haven't planted them. So everything else was sprouting, but there was these two trays. She said, I'm really worried about these two trays. So what she'd done, she'd put the soil in, and she'd put a label, she'd written the label out and put the label in, but she'd forgotten to plant the seeds. I said, there's a lesson there that I'll use in class sometime. It's like that, isn't it? Book distribution is, we're planting the seeds. If you forget to water, you forget to put them in a warm place. You may put the label, and the label says preaching. Okay? The label says preaching. I'm preaching. But if they're not sprouting, something's gone wrong with your seed planting. You may not have planted seeds deep enough. This is the thing. So therefore, Prabhupada says we do six things when we go preaching. He says, stay for some time. That's the one. And do these six things. Distribute my books. Go on Harinam Sankirtan. Give a little prasadam. Give some leaflet free. Answer their questions. And in the evening, hold a program in a hall or a school or someone's home. He said, you do these six things. He wrote that in 1973 to devotees here in England. He said, you can travel everywhere. But gradually, we dropped this, and we dropped talking to people, and we dropped prasadam, and we dropped Harinam Sankirtan. Harinam Sankirtan is now on the verge of extinction, practically everywhere. You know, we look at all these beautiful videos of Harinam Sankirtan, the Harinam Ruchi party, all over the world, but it's the same six boys. And so people look and they think, wow, Harinam's going on everywhere, in Peru and China and Russia. It's just six boys with tickets to go all around the world. Lovely job if you can get it, Govinda, isn't it? They just keep traveling. And lucky for us that they do keep traveling. You know, Israel, they're always on a beach somewhere, always having fun. Have you noticed? It's great, great life. But there's just six of them, and it's always the same boys. A few variations. Anyway, the point here is that in 1977, Dhanavir, now Dhanavir Goswami, was living here at the Manor, and we had the first Bhakta program. Actually, he'd done it in L.A., and he was here. So he was doing the Bhakta program. Prabhupada had written to him while he was at Bhaktivedanta Manor. He said, hello. Suffer the children to come to me, Jesus said. He said, you can keep a newsletter, just like a Sankirtan newsletter. You can keep a newsletter for making new devotees. And you can send it all over the world. These are the days before internet. And so he took the results of the new devotees that we were making. And sure enough, when you begin counting things, okay, when you begin counting seeds sprouting, you realize when they're not sprouting. When you start counting books, you suddenly realize how actually book distribution has dropped. When you count new devotees, okay, you realize how much making new devotees has dropped. But if you stop counting them, you don't notice that there's no new devotees coming forward. We lost 85 devotees in 1 year because of a spiritual leadership crisis in 1982. so the command went out, distribute books, and make devotees. And in 1 year, 100 devotees had come. 100 devotees. 100 people were initiated. And they went on to open temples and do so many things. But because we put a focused effort, and the Hare Krishna movement has to, you know, we have to do that from time to time, because we have bad seasons and we have good seasons. But the good seasons come after the bad seasons. The bad seasons are where you recognize, actually, these seeds are not coming up. Something's happening here. So, anyway, that's my favorite topic, but it's got nothing to do with the Ramayana. So anyway, I was in Africa, and it was in 1979, and Chaitanya Charitamrita came out in 1975. So back in the day, I couldn't even conceive of a person having four wives. It was just beyond me. My father couldn't even maintain one wife. What to speak? My father couldn't even, well, one wife at a time. But that's not what is meant here. Four wives at the same time. And of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is speaking in a country that is dominated by, not by Hindu law, but by Sharia law. Our culture, our whole Chaitanya Vaishnavite culture, was generated from a country in which Sharia law was the law. So four wives, no problem. But if you were born in a Muslim country and you took to Krishna consciousness, then you could be killed in the marketplace. Imagine that. Imagine living in a country where if you're born in a Muslim family but you take to Krishna consciousness, you're going to be killed in public. And that's what they wanted to do with Haridas Thakur. We often say Haridas Thakur was whipped in 22 marketplaces. And that's only half the story. Actually, they wanted to kill him. But because he wouldn't die, then they moved on to another marketplace because it was so embarrassing being in this marketplace. And he didn't die, that they had to move him to another marketplace. Okay? And they kept moving him until they'd moved him to 22 marketplaces. And then he ran out of markets. And they just begged him, please die. Please die. Because if you don't die, we will die. So he said, all right. The point here is that he was an apostate, which is an extremely serious thing. Now, given the present climate, where Sharia law is definitely on the rise, is definitely something that we have to encounter in our life as devotees. I see the future. It is very important for us now to have an understanding of how Krishna consciousness will be taught and communicated in a world which is not only atheistic, but in a world which is really doubling up against ancient religions, where people are taught to wear certain clothes, and you know. But how do we hold our own culture, and at the same time face the challenge of dealing with people who really don't want someone in with a strange haircut and a funny hat and robes telling them how to live their life? So yesterday I was invited to a gathering, a meeting, at the South Bank Centre in London. It's part of a series of talks. And the talks were entitled Belief and Beyond Belief, What It Means to Be Human in the 21st Century. And it was convened by a Muslim man who's a writer and a journalist. But when he was learning how to be a good Muslim, his teacher, he came to this Maulana, his teacher had a Sanskrit chart, you know, some Sanskrit writing on the back of the wall where his desk was. So he was teaching the Quran, and on the back was this piece of Sanskrit. So he said, what is this? I think he said, Kaka, what is this? He was from Punjab. He said, what is this writing? This is not Arabic. He said, no. He said, this is Bhagavad Gita. He said, but Bhagavad Gita is a Hindu book. He said, no. No. It is wisdom. Wisdom. Anyway, so that was the seed that was planted inside him. So that was why yesterday he was asking me in front of a crowd of 70 people who had paid £15 to be in the room, which is rather nice. How much did you pay to be in here today? I like giving a class when people have paid to be there. It's reassuring. 70 people, £15 each. He said, could you chant that 1854? You know, that 1854. Okay, so chanted 1854, Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma. So we were discussing three verses. And we started off on 2:12, and the idea was, what has the Bhagavad Gita got that would really solve the current political, and we have a big problem of political correctness, as the Daily Mail would say. On the one hand, we have political correctness gone mad, and on the other side, we have the idea of tolerance and patience and seeing everybody as equal. And the postmodern sensibility is that you use the higher aspects of religion, spirituality, to say that everybody's equal. And that should solve the problem, that should just fix the problem. Well, the person that said that everybody was equal also said that there's something called Varnashram. And Varnashram subsists on seeing everybody as not equal. So how is that? How do we correlate the two? Well, Krishna correlates the incorrelatable. Okay, the two things have to go together. People are different on the outside. People are the same inside. When people have realized that their transcendental nature is their actual identity, then they behave as if they are not their labels. If they have not understood that, then they behave as if they're their labels. So the very first principle is 2:12, na tvevaham jatu nasham. You are eternal. You will always be eternal. And that which you call yourself as your identity is merely your labels. We know these things, but it's interesting how many people don't. So don't think that people can understand these things. When people think of religion, they think of the differences. I went to Lambeth Palace not so long ago, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, as a name dropper, isn't it? The Archbishop of Canterbury said to me, he said, the difficulty with religion and teaching religion in general is that most people start their appreciation of a religion with what is called the phenomenological approach, which means, what hat do they wear when they go to their place of worship? Do they bow down, lie down, put their hands together in a namaste? What do they do? What foods do they eat? What foods don't they eat? How do the women dress? How do they treat their women? How do they deal with property? It's all external, what we might call the exoteric aspects. The esoteric aspects is, what is the self? Just answer that question. So I was going through these different layers with the audience, and they were like this. And I got the first, when I said, I drew myself up to my first height. I said, so therefore, there is the soul is the soul is the soul in everyone. There is no such thing as a Hindu soul, a Christian soul, or a Muslim soul. Hooray! And people came to me afterwards and said, I just want to thank you for that. What you said was so amazing. And of course, it's just 2:12. There's so much I could tell you. There's a whole 18 chapters to go. But this principle would solve an awful lot of problems. It would solve a lot of problems. Therefore, we have an interesting phenomenon in Israel, where traditionally the Arabs and the Jews have been at loggerheads for a long time. What's happening now is the devotees are going out with the Arabs doing prasadam distribution together. So, doing prasadam distribution together, just to send out a message that we can work together. I mean, it's very, very important. Except at the same time, is it possible for a person to be really respectful of another human being who happens to follow a religion that is different from their own externally, and yet at the same time retain their critical thinking? Yes, I think it is. I think what we have to do, Vaishnavas have to be very argumentative when it comes to philosophy. We have to. Otherwise, as an individual, you lose faith. And as a movement, you become very weak if we're not intellectually sharp. This cannot be true because of this point of philosophy. What you're saying, what your holy book says, I respect you as a person, but I have to say that this principle cannot, there's a higher principle. Of course, that's when you're challenged to debate. So we're very respectful of persons, but we have to be very, not disrespectful, but we have to be very, we have to engage in critical thinking. So what some devotees have done to me is that they have jumped on something which is, it seems to be a spiritual bandwagon, but is actually a postmodern bandwagon. Postmodernism started in the 1950s, and it's a movement really after the war, the Second World War, which was so devastating, simply because one group of people said, we are the supreme group of people, and you are not, and therefore our job is to, you know, reduce your capacity and basically turn you into slaves. That is what this particular type of fascism did in the Second World War. So people had to live with that. So the way you cope with the problem is to do the very opposite of the problem. So with the United Nations and with this, the postmodern development, the whole thing was that let's, in our politics, in the way we look at people, in our society, let's do away with the differences between people. And the result is chaos. The result is chaos. Because Varnashram, the way forward for human society, is organizing it on the basis of the differences between people. Unless there's a difference between a Brahmin and a Kshatriya, you can't organize them. Unless there's a difference between a Kshatriya and a Sudra, you won't know what they're supposed to be doing. How can you keep organization in society? And yet, Vaishnavism, beginning with 2:12, says, actually, we're all equal. So how do we correlate these two? Well, luckily, we have one society, that we're interacting with, and then we have an outside society that we're interacting with. So we are called upon to behave in different ways. It's a long subject. I didn't really want to get into the subject, but I was just saying that. So a lady came up to me yesterday, a few of them came up to me, and she said, look, I'm from a Muslim family, born Muslim, but I always thought that there was something more. And today what you've said has enriched my own understanding. And that's all we're asking for. We don't want, as Prabhupada said many times, we don't want Christians to become Hindus. We don't want Hindus to become Muslims. We want people to become God-conscious in their own tradition. You chant your name of God, we will chant our name of God. If you want to chant our name of God, very good, but chant the name of God. Chant the name of God. And that was Prabhupada's preaching, certainly when he went to Tehran. You know, what are you going to do when you go to Tehran? How are you going to preach? You preach as you would wish your disciples to preach in Tehran. But if you're shallow in your religion, all you'll have is the external aspects. And Krishna also comes to strip that away from you as well. Don't think that you're a devotee because you're wearing tilak. Oh no. Don't think that you're a devotee because you're wearing a sari. Especially you. Don't think that you're a devotee because you're, you know, you've got the externals right. Even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is what he said. Don't think that you become more of a devotee by learning mudras. He said this one time, you know, because we Hari Bhakti Vilas, you know, there's mudras, you know, there's sort of, you know, we've seen, you know. He said, don't think that you, he said, these mudras may just increase your Purush Bhav, may just increase your enjoying tendencies. Prabhupada said many times, don't get caught up with the ritual. But now the postmodern tendency that affects some of our devotees is that, to hell with rituals. Okay? I've even heard devotees say, ah, to hell with the Vedas. My dear friends, isn't that the third offense? Is it the third or the fourth? One of them. What is it?
Fourth.
It's a fourth, yeah. So how can you possibly say that? And that they do under the spell of the mode of passion. Mode of passion says, this is the religious principle, and to hell with the others. And the mode of passion then says, no, this is the religious principle, and to hell with the others. And so we have to rise above that, because as one writer said recently, he said, in religion, religion is like a swimming pool, he said. All the noise comes from the shallow end. That's one for you, Shruti. So religion is like a swimming pool. All the noise, because they're all children. They only go up to here with their religion. They don't understand it very deeply. But the adults, they can swim in the deep end, you know. So we have to be grown-ups. And grown-up discussion means taking us beyond the differences to the similarities. Okay? And my host was just looking at me and nodding very vigorously. So, oh, thank you. Thank you for that. Anyway, so that was good. I have not always been an appreciator of the extremities of the wonders that I read in Scripture until I went to Africa. You take an English man and you put him in Africa, and Mother Nature in Africa is very bounteous. You see things that you can never imagine in Africa. Somehow India doesn't have it. I never quite got it in India. You know, the birds are black or brown. Okay? Isn't it? And maybe you get a kingfisher occasionally, a little flash of turquoise. But I'm not really impressed by the trees in India. But the only thing impressive in India really is the jasmine, lotus, you know, maybe a few things like this, you know. But in Africa, you have a beetle, and the beetle is 6 inches long and bright turquoise, and it's flying. It's like something out of a sci-fi movie, you know. And, you know, once I was sweeping the temple room floor, and what looked like a piece of newspaper, so I swept it, and it was this big, and it was a moth. It just flew off, and I went, whoa. Anyway, one time, I tell these stories all the time. But what was I going to say? Oh, no. Anyway, yeah, one time we had a brahmachari, African brahmachari, nice boy from the Luo tribe. There's different tribes in Kenya where I was. There's Maasai, everybody knows. There was the Samburu, there was the Luo, and there was the Kikuyu. And so many different tribes and other smaller ones that the president of the country was always worried about tribalism. This is the thing. Religion can often go down into tribalism. And so he said, we have one country, one nation, and your tribe is very much the thing that, just keep it to yourselves. But above all, you are a Kenyan, he would say. And every public building had to display his framed picture, a large picture, including the temple. So the president of Kenya, because we're a public building. And there was only one person that was allowed to be called the president, and it was him. So one chief, one image, and this is the way that you spread teachings everywhere. Now you imagine, Prabhupada did that also, isn't it? One founder acharya, his image in every temple, his image in every book. On the front piece, the frontispiece is Prabhupada's picture. On the back, you'll find Prabhupada's picture. Why? Because when you're taking very diverse groups of people, you want to have a unifying effect. So it was a very good political move. Not just because Founder Acharya is the spiritual teacher. You don't get that in a lot of other organizations. Because organizations crumble unless you have a unifying principle. One of the big problems that they're worried about now is that after all the Prabhupada disciples have passed away, will ISKCON still have that unifying principle? Because right now, the Prabhupada disciples can stick together, and at least they can agree on certain key factors that Prabhupada spoke. Will that happen after they're all gone? That's for you to decide, everybody in this room. So this brahmachari is from the Luo tribe, and I said, so, what do your mum and dad think about you becoming a brahmachari? He said, oh, my father is really, really upset. I said, really? Is he like a rich man? He said, yeah, he's very rich. He's a district commissioner, which means he looks after a region of Africa. He's a political person. I said, so why is he so upset? He said, well, because I was the only boy. I said, really? The only boy in the family. Everybody else was daughters. I said, well, how many other children did your father have? He said, he had 63 daughters. That's what I said. More like a 63 daughters. 63 daughters. I said, well, hang on a minute. I said, I read about that in the Bhagavatam. How's that possible? He said, no, 63. I said, well, how many wives did your father have? He said, 63. I had one child with each one. Now, have you ever heard of that? You never heard of that. Okay? Happens in Arabia, happens in other places, but I thought it's in the pages of the Bhagavatam. 63 sisters this boy had, and he was the only son. And his father was expecting so much from him, and then he became a brahmachari. That's it. Family over. It was like, Prajapati Daksha with the Hariashvas and the Savalashvas. Narada Muni came and preached to them, and it was all over for the family. So we are celebrating. How long have I got? 9 o'clock is okay? 9 o'clock is okay. We are celebrating Ram Nomi today. And the reason I've been speaking, as I often speak, is because, not because now I want to tell you the story of the Ramayana, because I know you're all grown-ups, you know the story. And many people know the story much better than me, and they've been here, and you've been raised, a lot of you, on the story. Okay? And I'm an Englishman, so what do I know? But I will tell you that the Ramayana is longer than the Bhagavatam. It's 24,000 verses. And each section, each of the 24 each of the chapters begin, each of the sections begins with one syllable from the Gayatri Mantra. This is the secret code that's woven into the Ramayana by Valmiki. And in these 24,000 verses, we have an exposition of the incarnation of God who came to establish Maryad. And sometimes we translate Maryad as, you know, the line, the borders. Maryad is actually a dividing line between two fields. It's like a wall, or in some parts of this country, you get a dry, what is it called, a dry stone wall. And down in Cornwall, where I'm from, you get a huge hedge that's covered in wildflowers, big old thing. In some parts of the country now, you get a wooden fence. Maryad, it separates what is one person's property from another person's property. Okay? That's the key function of a Maryad. So Maryad tells you what to do because it tells you what you're allowed to do and what belongs to someone else. And Varnashram runs on this principle. So because Krishna came as a king, he came as Maryad Purushottam. He came as the supreme person who is concerned with establishing religious principles. And the first religious principle is what's mine, what's yours. It's really, really what it's about. What is mine, what is yours, what's his, what's hers. Okay? And now we can work on, you know, all the God stuff. We can work on the soul and we can understand in God. But first of all, understand who you are, what proprietary rights you have. Why is that important? Because unless you have that, society breaks down and you have chaos. When you have chaos in a society, there's no peace. Patanjali Muni said, before you can do dharana and dhyan and samadhi, there's got to be peace. For yoga to take place, there has to be peace. Now, I know, Bhagavad Gita was spoken in a place where there's no external peace. But that was an unusual situation. Even Krishna didn't want the Kurukshetra war to happen. Once, twice, three times, Krishna was the peacemaker trying to stop the war. Because wherever you have war, for a long time afterwards, you get problems. You get massive problems. Just like it's an act of war when someone drives a vehicle on Westminster Bridge and kills people. Okay? It's an act of war. Some people die, and it's over for them. They're already in their next body. We grieve, but it's finished. The after effect for their relatives and the after effect for people who are injured is devastating year after year after year. People suffer disfigurements. But no newspapers talk about how they're coming to terms with their difficulty. We just see, you know, somebody killed, somebody injured. And the injured, we never hear about them again. One time, this Indian doctor came to Soho Street, and I sat down with him to talk to him. I said, what do you do for a living? He said, I'm a doctor. He said, actually, I'm a trauma manager. I said, what does that mean? He said, well, I look after when there's been a big disaster in London. I said, such as? He said, well, I was the trauma manager for the 7/7 bombings on the tube in London. His job, basically, was to think very quickly. And a person has to think very quickly because if you dawdle, someone with a terrific injury is going to die. So you have to be shouting. It's a real situation of chaos. It's like a battlefield. This one, stop the bleeding. This one, resuscitation. This one, it's too late. This one, the person's been dead for 5 minutes. That's mortuary. So you really like that. And you're thinking. He said, but no one knows. He said, I feel I had to come to the temple today. He said, but because no one knows the extent of an injury in a bomb blast. He said, we hear about the dead, but no one hears about the extent of the injuries. These injuries, you know, you lose a leg or you lose an arm or you lose an eye. That's it. Your job is gone. Your family is gone. Sometimes with an injury, even your wife is gone because, you know, the family income is... Chanakya Pandit said every wife is tested in the time of financial adversity. So the first thing in a society that the Kshatriya has to do is to establish peace. Now, peace isn't the goal. One time Prabhupada was talking about peace and he said, he made a face with his lips, he said to the Prabhupada, he said, "We are not interested in this peace. We are not interested in this peace." And he said the word peace as if it was something bad. Peace. Okay? Meaning that we're not interested in peace as a goal. We're interested in peace as a means to reach the goal. Even in the society, Prabhupada was always trying to make peace. This sannyasi and this householder, just be peaceful. You go here, you go preach in China. You know, you be peaceful. You know, the ladies can do this, the men can be like this. No, you can go and live on the farm, and you can go travel, distribute books. He's always trying to keep peace within ISKCON, because if you have peace within the society, then they can go and they can distribute books and do all the other stuff. But if you don't have peace, if you have controversy all the time, who can take shelter? We have always have controversy. Should we do this? Should we do that? Therefore, you have to have the Kshatriya principle. The Kshatriya principle is, I'm in charge, this is what you do. That's a Kshatriya. I'm in charge, this is what you do. And if you don't agree, go somewhere else. That's the Kshatriya principle. That's how it works. Kshatriyas, it says their hearts are like a razor blade. Okay? They just chop. They cut. That's what they're trained to do. But their mouth is like warm butter. They'll speak to you so nicely. But their hearts are like a razor blade. A Brahmin, his heart is like warm butter. But his mouth, my God, a Brahmin's mouth is like a razor blade. They say, one of our gurus, Vyadiraj Tirtha, he said, when the words about the Mayavadis and the other kind of religious principles that did not match up to the Vedic principle, when he was speaking about that, when it came out of his mouth, it came out like a hammer. Ching, 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 ching. And this, and this, and this. But his heart was like soft butter. Oh, watch out with the Kshatriya. And the Kshatriya comes to you, and he put his arm around you during the Japa period. That's the Kshatriya. And he'll say, "Jai, how are you doing in your spiritual life, Prabhu? I noticed, actually, that you're doing really well. We just need someone to go and clean out the pots in the kitchen. Do you think that you could?" That's a Kshatriya. Okay? I'm just joking. Maybe they don't do that anymore. But in society, we have to keep the peace. Therefore, the most unassailable people are we have to have, although everything becomes degraded in Kali Yuga, we have to have the politicians, we have to have the police force, we have to have the judiciary. Everything becomes corrupted. I'm not making excuses for them, but we have to have them as a principle. Then the Brahmins can get on and do their bit. Okay? Then the Brahmins can get on and do their bit. If there's no peace, the Brahmins are the first to go. When communism takes over, the Brahmins were the first to be killed. Okay? Anyone that's religious, anyone that's got glasses, that was the measurement. Anyone who's an intellectual gets, you know, smashed or restricted or reduced. Okay. Anyway, so Lord Ram comes. He's the eighth incarnation. And Ram's story is told as far away as Africa. There's a Ramayana in Ethiopia. There's a Ramayana in Cambodia. There's a Ramayana in Singapore, in Thailand, in Indonesia, in Bali. Every one of these countries has a Ramayana. Ramayana is such a wonderful story because it's created by the most wonderful storyteller, God himself. If God can create a lotus flower and the delicate artistry of a bee that lands in the lotus flower and takes the pollen at the same time as getting it, that's the God that can make the beautiful story. Okay? Beautiful story. So he's so loved because in that story you can enter into the story. Kulashekar Alwar, very famous, he entered into the story so much that the Brahmins would not read to him the certain parts of the story where Sita was troubled or Sita had been kidnapped, because the problem was he would fall into such an ecstatic trance that he would start calling the army to go and help Ram. And because he was the king, no one could say, "I'm sorry, you know, you You may be the king, but you can't order your army. It's his army. And so one day a young Brahmin came and he didn't know the rules. So he read out this story, and Kulashekhar Alwar was, you know, he got his army and started marching, and then the other Brahmins had to go in front and say, no, no, it's all right. Ravana's been destroyed. Sita's been returned to Ayodhya. And he said, oh, okay, let's go back to the palace. He entered into the pastime. It even said, when Radhanath Swami tells the story, he has Kulashekhar Alwar on his horse in the sea. He's going into the sea, and the Brahmins have to go into the sea and just, you know. Okay. Okay. So Lord Ram loves his devotees and all those who surrender to him. The Sri Vaishnavas, they look at the Ramayana as the Sharanagati Shastra. And they pick out, they also cherry pick. They pick out the bits where the soul's relationship with Godhead is demonstrated by a character in the Ramayana surrendering to either God or someone. And one of the biggest ones is when Vibhishan surrenders to Ram. And Vibhishan is Ravana's brother. He turns coat on him and he comes to take shelter of Ram. He sees his brother's up to no good. This is wrong. This is adharma. So he comes. And he has to wait for some time even before he can get the darshan of Ram. And then even when he does, the warriors, the monkey warriors say, well, you know, he's the brother of your enemy. He's the brother of the person that we're coming to defeat now. Why should you accept his surrender? Because surrendering to a person is one thing, but the other half of that is that the surrender is accepted. You know, we often think, oh, and now I can get initiated by Prabhupada. Prabhupada's there. He's there for the next 10,000 years. I'll get initiated by him. Well, wait a minute. Who are you again? You may surrender to Prabhupada, but that doesn't mean that Prabhupada accepts you. That's the other half of the deal. You surrender to Prabhupada, but has he accepted you? Unless you can categorically say that Prabhupada has accepted you, then you only have half an initiation, which is in it. It's just your imagination. So here we want, did Ram accept Vibhishan? And so when Ramanujacharya was telling this story, one of his devotees started to cry because he heard that Lord Ram was delaying accepting the surrender of Vibhishan. And he started to cry. He was just sitting there in the audience and Sri Rangam, or Ramanuja, was giving a class. His name was Pillai Urangavili Dasar. And he was just, tears were coming down. Ramanuja heard him. He said, what's the matter? He said, if Ram, I was just thinking, if Ram keeps him waiting, what about me? I have no chance. Because the part of the narration is that the monkeys were saying, he's like this, he's like that, he's like this, he's like that. And they were giving a catalog of the Bishan's disqualifications. He said, no, no. He said, because you're connected with me, and I'm definitely connected with Ram, he said, then I'll bring you to Ram. So in that tradition, the Guru Nishta is very strong because the Guru is accepted not just as a person who can, you know, give a mantra and write you a letter every month or two or three, but the Guru is accepted as a person who is connected to Krishna, intimately connected to Krishna, and can therefore connect you into that circle. So Ram's service to humanity was to give us Mariyad. There are two things, Mariyad and Leela. Leela Purushottam, Mariyad Purushottam. Two things are harmonious, but one comes first. Like with Patanjali, the yoga sutras, the yama niyam come first. The rules and regulations come first, then you get the ecstasy at the end. You know, and then Prabhupada said, work now, samadhi later. Where he said that, we don't know. But it's so good that we carry on repeating it. Work now, samadhi later. So the point here is that the work that you have to do is repressing the senses. or engaging the senses in service to Krishna with a mood of subduing them, because they're the things that will take you away from conceiving of your nature as a spiritual being. And so where a person doesn't do that, and where a person focuses on lila without the mariad, then we get a tendency for what the Christians used to call in Greek antinomianism. Antinomianism. It means to discard the rules and regulations, thinking that I've already transcended them. Like yesterday, there was a, I hope he's not watching today, but there was an Indian man in the front row. Indian man means the question is 20 minutes long. Okay. And so the speaker was, the chairman was saying, yeah, that's very, very good. So I, let me just, so now my question is, after 10 minutes, he said, so in the last 6 weeks, I've read all the Vedas and all the Upanishads, and I've come to the conclusion that, and I had to smile. The past 6 weeks, I've read everything, and I've come to the conclusion that, okay, stop there for a minute, please. Okay, just wait. Stop. I think you're getting ahead of yourself. You're getting so ahead of yourself that you've tripped over your own ego. The point is that it's lifelong commitment. Lifelong commitment. But a antinomianist is a person who believes that because he has a special relationship with God, God can move him, either it's the Holy Spirit or whatever, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or whoever it is. But it is something akin to a mental problem. Therefore, we find that the whole history of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement was blighted by two things. One was Sharia, restricting it, diminishing it, controlling it, manipulating it. And the second thing was Sahajya. Sharia and Sahajya. This is our history. This is the history from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu down to Bhaktivinod Thakur. We had some pure souls living in different places, but by external political constriction and internal antinomianism, the whole community was practically lost. So these are the two things that we also have to be very careful of. Is postmodern tendency. It is, you know, there's one of the facets of that is something called deconstructionism. It's where you take a liturgy or you take the religion and you dissect it. You know, the whole point is that you know, if you take a frog and you pin it to a board in the laboratory and you dissect it, you no longer have a frog. You just have pieces of a frog, right? So if you take the Krishna consciousness movement and you say, well, let's pin it to a board of rational, you know, intellectualism and cut it open and dissect it and start taking pieces away, it's no longer alive. That's the thing. You've killed it. In order to deconstruct it, you've killed it. So one person thinks, let's do away with this. Another person thinks, let's do away with this. Another person says, let's do away with this. And we're all going for the higher principle, higher principle, higher principle. And it's all in a spirit of helping it. But what happens is that you get the, you destroy the mariad ultimately, because you introduce the principle that I am the arbiter of change. I can introduce change. And then he thinks he can introduce change. So everybody's changing. Lord Jesus Christ stood on top of a hill and he spoke to a few hundred people. That's it. Finish. End of the story. That's it. The Sermon on the Mount. All the teachings he ever wanted to teach. Now, if you look at the annual yearbook of Christianity, you'll find there's 47,000 different churches. And each of them have got the truth. Each of them have got the truth. That's the problem. That's the problem. And it means that Christianity as a world force for good is reduced. So the Krishna consciousness movement is a force for good. But in there, because of us and the motive passion, there will be tribalism, sectarianism, logical positivism. There will be antinomianism, all the isms. All the isms all stay as seeds. Okay? The point is, we have to find what unites us. We have to understand that we have control because we have one organization, and that's how it is meant to be. That's Ram's contribution. Otherwise, the Leela takes over, and you have the spirit of Sahaja, free interpretation, because God is speaking to me. When once you allow yourself that privilege, then you're away with the fairies. And I've seen it. I've seen good people taken away. I mean, too much for stories, but I've seen good people taken away. It's very very easy thing to do. So for me, the essence of Ram coming is to establish that Mariyad. And we see that in every single instance, Ram did not do the easy thing. He did the difficult thing. But it was the right thing. Often, the right thing to do is the harder of two choices. Okay? But when it's the right thing to do, Mariyad says, do it because it's the right thing to do. But unless you know what is right and what's wrong, how can you make that choice? Your power of discrimination doesn't exist because you don't know what's right and what's wrong. You know? What tilak should I put on? Okay? You know it's taken 400 years of history to get to the tilak we have now. You want to change that? Yeah, I do, because I like the color. Okay? Singing this particular mantra and not that particular mantra. Okay? It's taken 500 years of history to get to this point. Okay? Well, I like singing that song. Well, you may like it, but is it the right choice? If you don't know that it's the wrong choice, then you won't when you take that choice. The other time is when a person is crippled by rules and regulations and can't think outside the box or outside the temple. We also want to avoid that. Therefore, devotees come to Oxford with Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada's about to give a class. And you know how devotees treat microphones. Devotees, you know, if there was an international council for microphone abuse, you know, devotees would be at the top of the list. You see devotees. You know, all it takes is sort of like 6 months of that, and that's it. You have a good quality microphone stand. You know, treat it, it's a delicate thing. It's a very delicate, it's a microphone, okay? It's an electronic piece of equipment. Okay, treat it nicely. Snap. Oh, it broke. I don't know, why did it break? So the microphone was broken. Prabhupada wanted to speak. And so he brought a devotee forward. You all know this story. He said, give me your Brahmin thread. So he went for the Brahmin thread. And he said, you want me to... Srila Prabhupada, do you want me to give you my Brahmin thread that you gave to me? He said, give me your Brahmin thread. So he took the thread and Prabhupada just used it to tie the microphone to the stand. But when to do that, when to think outside the form and when to work inside the form, that you have to be very careful. Because you send out a signal that now I'm a form breaker. So then you get left with nothing. Like the man whose wife, she said, go buy some ghee in the marketplace. You know that story, final story. Go buy some ghee in the marketplace. He went to the ghee seller. He said, my ghee pours so nicely, it just pours like oil. He said, well, why am I buying ghee? I should buy oil. That's better. So he went to the oil seller. He said, oh, my oil pours so nicely, it just pours like water. He said, oh, I'll go buy some water. So he went and he paid for water that was being given out freely. He took that back to his wife. She said, what's this? He said, well, you know, by a process of logical discrimination, based on a hierarchy of pouring principles, I've come to the conclusion that water is better than ghee. Okay, well, she said, my rolling pin is better than your head. Whack. So the point is, you can speculate your way out of Krishna consciousness completely. But here's the difficulty. We speculated our way into Krishna consciousness. we use the faculty of intelligence and discrimination and intellectual, rational reasoning to come to Krishna consciousness. So it's a trusted friend. It's a trusted friend. But no, there's a point at which you're meant to say, okay, let me say, this is my intelligent faculty, my reasoning power, and this is the guru's instructions. These are the Vedas. Okay, let me just use this to understand this, rather than taking this and putting it underneath this. You see? It's a different principle. Should we finish? Should we have breakfast? The Maryad has been breached. It's 9 o'clock. All right. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sri Ramachandra ki jai. Sri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai. Sri Ram Nomi Maha Mahotsava ki jai.